Well, firstly, can I say thank you very much indeed for giving up your time to discuss what, as Andrew said, is an important and timely debate for the Labour Party. Let me maybe begin by picking up a point that Andrew made in his introduction. In all honesty, I don't think the right response for the Labour Party is to be planning now for a Conservative-led referendum on Europe. I think the right response for the Labour Party is to be planning and working for a Labour government with Ed Miliband as Prime Minister. And it's in that spirit I speak to you. Now, despite the title of this particular conference, I don't actually believe that Britain's continued membership of the European Union is just a left-right issue. For me, it's basically a right-wrong issue. I say this because I believe that those opposed to our membership of the European Union are not just on the wrong side of the political divide, the wrong side of the argument, but with the greatest respect to them, they're on the wrong side of history. Let me explain what I mean. If in the last century the case that we made for Europe was one of peace and prosperity, the 21st century, I believe, demands a case for Europe made on the basis of power and influence. In the past, if you wanted to see the foundations on which the case for Europe was built, not just here in Britain, but right around the continent, sadly, you only needed to look at the war graves and memorials that were strewn across the conflict-ridden continent. For my father's generation, that was a matter of memory. But for my son's generation, that's simply a matter of history. So today, in arguing the case for Europe, we need to acknowledge that we live, and will live in the decades ahead, in an era of billion-person countries, trillion-dollar economies, and so the need to find ways to amplify our voice and multiply our powers as the United Kingdom is pressing and indeed different from the challenge of the last century. Now, in that sense, the case for Britain's continued membership of the European Union is not for me a matter of outdated sentiment, however sincerely felt. It's not even a matter of progressive ideology, progressive though it is in its impact. It is a simple matter of arithmetic. Indeed, if mechanisms for cooperation at a European level didn't exist today, I would be arguing that as the Labour Party we should be creating those mechanisms. Now, of course, the deep ties between France and Germany, born from a conviction that they should never repeat those conflicts of the first half of the 20th century, means that the European Union was and remains fundamental to the national purpose and the psychology of both of those great European powers. Now, of course, Britain also wants peace and security. But our experience in the last century was different, and so our approach to Europe has also been different. It has always been more pragmatic than visionary. We want to be part of the European Union because it works for us, both as a country, but also because it serves our interests as individuals. And that approach has been Labour's starting point on Europe for many years, indeed decades now, and will continue to be our case. But let me pause here for a moment, because I suspect that this will seem unconvincing, but familiar argument to many of us gathered in this room this morning. Many of us have made this case. Many of you have probably made the case far more eloquently than I, and others will continue to do so on stages like this in the years ahead. So today I want to try and do something different. Indeed, I want to make a different speech, and I want to try and set out a different case for Europe. Not because I don't believe those are good arguments, but because I think, like all of our politics, we have to start with where the public are, and not just where we would like the public to be. I believe the public mood has changed in recent years, and therefore so too must the case that we make to engage with them. Let me try and explain why. Few would deny that today's political context is fundamentally different to the one that existed when the European project was first conceived. Indeed, it is this understanding that explains why the justification shifted from peace and prosperity towards power and influence. But I wanted to make the case to you today that we found ourselves at a juncture where, once again, our case needs to change, or indeed, we risk drifting into irrelevance in some of the arguments that we make. The political context in which we must make the case for Britain and Europe today is different from the one that existed even a few years ago, when Labour politicians in government, myself included, were tasked with articulating that case for membership. Because despite the difficulties and the setbacks, the broad trends of the post-war decades here in Britain were defined by growing prosperity and rising living standards. Today, we see falling wages, rising prices, stagnating growth. Only this week, in what I think will come to be judged as a landmark study, the Resolution Foundation published a report that made the case that average wages are not expected to rise in real terms until late 2014, after a period of stagnation and decline. Many people continued to work fewer hours than they would like, putting continued downward pressure, on household incomes and communities the length and breadth of our country. People in Britain today simply can't take for granted the fact that this generation will inevitably do better than the next. Now, in the context of growing insecurity and increasing financial pressures, voters today have much less appetite for things that may seem important to us as a nation, but ultimately at times feel remote from their concerns and fears that they have as a household or indeed as individuals. So I want to suggest that the case for Britain's membership of the European Union, as it has been articulated up until now, focused on securing power and influence as a nation, can feel remote at best and at times almost irrelevant to the daily concerns of many of our voters. To make the case for Britain's continued membership in this changed and challenging political and economic climate, we need to do so in a way that is rooted in the lived experience of the people here in the United Kingdom. For too long, the focus has perhaps been on defending Britain's place in Europe instead of explaining the positive impact that Europe has on many aspects of the lives of the citizens of the United Kingdom. Of course, that doesn't mean that we relinquish the arguments about Europe being a mechanism for multiplying power and amplifying influence in the decades ahead. Rather, we have to recognise that these arguments will only get us so far. They need to be supplemented with a new narrative which reflects the public's priorities and concerns while articulating how Europe can help them realise their goals. At a time of growing economic uncertainty and increasing personal financial strain, it should come as no surprise to any of us that I believe that the economy must therefore be at the heart of our approach to Europe. British jobs, British exports and British influence all benefit from Britain's continued membership. Simply to contemplate shrinking our home market from more than 500 million consumers to just 60 million simply doesn't make sense. Only this week we heard President Obama in his State of the Union address putting a free trade agreement between the US and the European Union at the very top of his agenda, and rightly so. And already the chorus of criticism from British businesses is growing following that speech from David Cameron last month, with senior British business figures, including Sir Richard Branson, Sir Martin Sorrell and others, warning the Prime Minister that his approach could lead to damaging uncertainty for British business. The economic case for our continued membership is robust and is being increasingly forcefully made by a broadening coalition of voices here in Britain. But it's not just exit that risks undermining economic stability and the prospects for growth. The uncertainty created, incidentally, by David Cameron committing now to an in-out referendum, halfway through this Parliament, to be held at least halfway through the next, does risk instability and undermining investment, precisely at a time when the priority for our economy should be stability, investment and growth. But also, the truth is his response to Europe, and indeed the speech that he made, in reality raised more questions than it answered. He can't actually tell the British public how he intends to vote in the referendum he would like to see. He can't be clear on what it is that people would be choosing between or staying out of. And he can't tell investors whether the United Kingdom will still be part of the world's largest single market in just over 4 years' time. Now, uncertainty is the enemy of investment, and David Cameron's approach has created a great deal more uncertainty at a time of great economic strain. And debate about the nature of our relationship with the European Union in the future should come not at the expense of living standards today. That should be at the heart of the case that we are making in our politics. when it comes to our position, for example, on the recently agreed European multi-annual financial framework, the EU budget for the next 7 years, our position was defined by an overriding need to not only work to ensure that the European Union better reflects people's concerns, but also that it was publicly seen to do so. Because at a time when national governments are making difficult cuts to spending on vital public services, it would not have been right, I would argue, for the European Union budget to have continued to rise year on year for the next 7 years. The EU budget still undoubtedly needs substantial reform to make it more focused on growth and jobs, but the reduction agreed this month was an important step because Europe must learn to do better with less. That's why we voted in the House of Commons for a real terms cut last year and support the fact that one was agreed at the European Council last month. But today I want to make the case for moving this debate on. I want to make the case that we need not just Europe as a framework to achieve jobs and growth, but also as a guardian of rights and protections. Because in reality, the impact of the European Union on people's lived experience extends beyond simply the impact on creating jobs, but also in defining the type, quality and security of those jobs and careers. The single market has delivered much more for Britain than simply the absence of tariffs and quotas or barriers to trade. It's delivered common regulatory standards, covering consumer rights, environmental standards, health and safety rules, without which it would be impossible for the single market to actually operate. The social market is a vehicle for protecting against exploitative working conditions, raising labour standards in a coordinated way, and embedding workers' rights within the very structures that encourage cooperation at a cross-border level. It is not a free-for-all for multinational companies, but a rules-based economic system that protects the vulnerable from the effects of unrestrained market forces. So if Labour is to make the case for Europe founded on the impact that it has on real people's lives, we have to make these protections for working people a key plank of our argument. The task is now for us to show, far from being abstract and remote pieces of European legislation, European social and employment laws are the basis for much valued rights and protections that help define the character of our society and the quality of life of many of our citizens. It's about practical things, like 4 weeks paid holiday, minimum maternity and paternity entitlements, protection against undercutting and mistreatment at work. We must not only seek to defend Britain's place in Europe, using the language, therefore, of structures, process or procedure. Instead, it is the language of paid holidays, equal pay and safety at work that will not only help us build the case, but ultimately, I believe, help us win the case. Let it be clear, this does not mean that Labour should defend every aspect of European social employment law, nor support its extension into new areas as a matter of principle. It is true that Jacques Delors' speech to the TUC back in 1988 promoted the European Union to members of the TUC, and in response, the TUC chairman in his day replied that after 10 years of Thatcherism, the EU was, and I quote directly, the only card game in town. But after more than a decade of Labour government, 13 years of Labour government, we know that that is no longer the case. After all, it was a Labour government here in the United Kingdom that introduced the national minimum wage, introduced the right to trade union representation, whistleblower legislation, upped maternity leave from 14 weeks to 9 months, introduced paternity leave for the first time ever, and got rid of discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation. Delors' speech to the 1988 TUC conference, placing a new social dimension at the heart of the argument for Europe, was perhaps the defining moment in reconnecting the Labour Party with the continent's mainstream centre-left. Today, the European Union is one vehicle, but not the only route to guaranteeing social protections and rights for British workers. So we should be prepared to point out legislation that we judge does not adequately meet that text, like on the Working Time Directive, when as a Labour government we negotiated and secured a British opt-out. Nor does it mean that we will argue for the centralisation of all social competences at an EU level. We do not believe that all rights and protections need to be guaranteed or set by the European Union. In a diverse union of 27 member states, the principle, the European principle of subsidiarity, including in social protection, remains crucial. But it does mean that where European social protections help working people here in the United Kingdom, we should be robust in our defence of these protections. Because we believe that a collective guarantee of a minimum set of standards that should be expected for life at work, agreed at a European level through collective decision making, has been a necessary, indeed vital component of the operation of the single market. Indeed, this approach is a necessary response to the at times wrenching social impacts of dramatic economic change that flow from increased cooperation, openness and competition, and not just the European Union, but indeed at a global level. For the countries of the European Union to overcome the challenge to the legitimacy of the European Union that today confronts us, responding to the unavoidable social consequences of these economic trends seems to me to be vital and deep unarguable. And let's be clear, the Conservatives' approach to social and employment rights in Europe is not simply driven by their narrow and dated views of British national interests and sovereignty, but also their wholly unreconstructed approach to markets and their impacts, and in turn, to the kind of British society that we want to see. David Cameron has long cited social and employment law as one of the areas where he wants to see the European Union doing less and the UK opt out. But he has been characteristically clear about what the implications of this would be for British jobs, for British employees, for British companies, indeed the protection of rights at work across Britain. He won't say, should this opt-out be achieved, that equivalent domestic legislation would be immediately introduced to ensure that standards are not put at risk. Indeed, even after David Cameron's recent speech, the Conservatives remained purposefully vague. The words employment law didn't feature at all in that speech. The word repatriation wasn't even mentioned. He didn't even utter the term opt-out. But the truth is this. Despite David Cameron's present obscurity, for many within the Conservative Party, what motivates them, really, when it comes to Europe, is to bring powers home in order to take protections away. For them, vital protections are seen simply as an unnecessary burden on business that should be scrapped in pursuit of victory in what they call the global race. You don't need to peer into the crystal ball to know what they are trying to do. You only need to read the book, or in this case, the Beecroft Report. Reducing the rights of staff in small companies, abolishing unfair dismissal, and finding ways of making it easier to fire people at will. That is what Beecroft calls a price worth paying. And for many Conservatives, this is the reality that lies behind the rhetoric of repatriation. So my case to you today is this. The Tories' approach to Europe doesn't just risk jeopardising our place in the world, our voice on the international stage, and indeed the prospects for stability and growth in our economy. They also risk unravelling the fabric of rights and protections that are such a crucial part of what defines the standards and quality of life that so many of my constituents and indeed people across the country today depend upon. The irony is that those who say they want the EU to go back to just being a free trade zone, which was incidentally what we left in order to join the European Economic Community, those people ignore the fact that the single market they yearn for is only sustained by the supranational institutions that they claim to detest. That is a point exposed just this week, as we heard from Jess's introduction, in relation to the horsemeat scandal. I mean, irony left the building when Owen Paterson, that Eurosceptic cabinet minister, was forced to scurry back to Brussels in order to demand tighter European Union regulation. In acknowledgement that, in an open and free market, effective EU legislation is precisely the protections and in the interests of the British people. So surely the lesson of the last decades is that without public legitimacy, the future of the European Union will always feel precarious. That is why building legitimacy is so important. And to ensure solid foundations for Britain's place in Europe, we must seek to make the case through reflecting the public's priorities and concerns: decent jobs, rising prosperity, rising living standards. For Labour, unlike some conservatives, being pro-reform is not actually just a proxy for being anti-Europe. Indeed, for Labour, the reform of Europe should not be seen as a question mark over our commitment to Britain's future within Europe. Instead, it is not just the safest ground, but also the most solid rock on which to build that positive case about Britain's membership of what the European Union can be and how it can best address the concerns of the British public. That is why, as Labour, we will continue to make the case for Britain's place in Europe, but also for the reform of Europe. This cannot be an argument made simply on the pages of national newspaper editorials, because it's an argument that is intertwined with the daily life, the daily concerns, the daily fears of the British public. I believe it is an argument that can and must be won, and now is the time for Labour to start making that case anew. Thank you very much.